On this week's 51%, we turn to a woman who talks about her unstill life and what it was like to have a father who worked among art and artists during the heyday of abstract expressionism. Then we hear about a conference on women and power that, for the first time, will include men.
We cannot empower women and girls unless we engage men and boys. It's just that simple.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. In 1958, when Gabrielle Sells was a year and a half old, she and her parents and her sister moved to New York, where her father, Peter Sells, would begin his job as the chief curator at the Museum of Modern Art. What followed was a childhood spent among art and artists. Her memoir, Unstill Life, A Daughter's Memoir of Art and Love in the Age of Abstraction, is a window into the world of the abstract expressionist movement of the 1960s and 1970s. 51%'s Joe Donahue spoke with Gabrielle Sells about her memoir.
You talk in the book about a child who is overshadowed by your father in many ways. At what point in your life do you feel you came to grips with that?
Now.
Okay. Did the book?
It's an ongoing process. My father's actually 95 now, and he's still working a little bit. Yeah, he's a very charismatic man, but he takes up a lot of space. And I think what he taught me, besides how to look at art and how to appreciate art, was also how to persist, you know, how to stick with something, how to carry it through. I mean, he's very good at that, and how to stay in the game no matter what. So I'm really grateful for that. But, yeah, it's been a struggle. I think it's a struggle my mother never quite realized. So it actually feels really good to have something of my own that also incorporates their lives.
And while there certainly was an overshadowing, you were very much a part of it. I mean, when the whether it be the parties and the moving from here to there, you were brought around.
There were no boundaries. And partly that was the culture of the times, the 60s and 70s. There were no boundaries in a lot of people's lives. But I think in the art world, it was more extreme, and the whole art was about breaking boundaries because, you know, it was abstract, and then it was on canvases that were unframed, and then it was off the canvas, and so the art and what was happening in the art world kind of mirrored what was happening in the real world, which where people were breaking down a lot of boundaries, sexually, politically, psychologically. So, yeah, we saw a lot of things that I have a child. I wouldn't necessarily want my child until he's older to witness and be part of.
You do write in the book that for my father, that world of privilege and power was more engaging than our domestic life. It was the art world that was all-encompassing.
Yeah, and the art, too. I mean, the art on the walls was as much a character in our home as the people, you know. It was kind of paramount. That's true. And he's very, I mean, the wonderful thing about my dad is he will, you know, cop to all that. He will admit that. He will acknowledge it. And I really appreciate that. But, yeah, it was a big job, and it required a lot of social life. So my parents averaged three parties a night sometimes. So we didn't see a lot of them.
And he was married five times, right?
And he's still married on his fifth marriage. And some of them were very brief. One was 2 months, one of those marriages. And when he wasn't married, there was usually a woman living in his house. My dad doesn't like being alone, and he likes a large audience. He works, you know, his house is big and open, and I think there's an image of it in the book. And his office is kind of like this stage that cantilevers out over the living room. So, you know, that's how he works and lives.
How do you believe art connected the two of you?
Well, I certainly believe, especially contemporary art and modern art, where, you know, it takes kind of a real engagement of the viewer. So I think it requires something of us to understand it, and I think with my dad, looking at art and understanding art and being part of that process where together we're looking at something and we're figuring it out, is a deep form of connection. It's something we share. I think it's certainly something he shared with my mother. I mean, they spent their youth just going around looking at art and kind of being vagabonds in Europe and then later on, you know, doing that same thing in New York. So it's a way of connecting, and it's also, it's a language. Neither of us are visual artists, but we are both writers, and we both write about art. And he shares what he writes with me, and I share what I write with him. And it's very powerful. It's very powerful.
Is there ever a time that you became jealous of it, that you were competing with it?
Of the art? I think I've been jealous of many things in my father's life. You know, I mean, when I was younger, it was the other women and the attention, and also sometimes these women came with children. And I felt, you know, he often shuffled the people around in his life like a deck of cards. So it very much felt like that, like musical chairs, more like, you know, you would run around and you had to be quick so your seat wouldn't be taken. And he was always busy and traveling. I think that my way of dealing with the jealousy, certainly with the art, was to become interested in it and become knowledgeable in it and sophisticated in it. And I did that from a very young age, without even knowing about it. My dad used to take me to the galleries with him on Saturdays. This is when they were up on Madison Avenue and 57th Street in New York. And he'd carry me in on his shoulders, and I could call out the names of everything I saw on the walls, and he would be very proud of me and show me off, and that made me feel valued, and that continued. So I think in the beginning I did it to connect with him and to impress him.
I've heard it both ways, and I don't know that I could completely tell in the book of you obviously had an interest in art, and you were fascinated by it. Did you get the opportunity when these famous artists were coming through in the house, and you were in the galleries and so forth? Did you have an opportunity to ask the questions that you had about the art
to them?
Yes.
Well, later on, when I was older, certainly. I mean, I've talked to Christo. I've known him since I was in college. And his wife, Jean-Claude, when she was still alive. But when I was a kid, I didn't. I knew their children, and they were around, and I remember them, and I remember certainly a lot of the conversations. And also because of my mother's journals, I could, she kept notes, meticulous notes of all of that. And I had that as an incredible source material. But I don't think I started really talking to artists about their work until I was older. I was a child.
Right. Would you
They played with me. I would go to Osario's studio out in East Hampton and, play with his material in his studio. But it was a different level of,
When you think of the opportunities that you had, when you think of the art that you've seen and the art that you've seen created and putting that into a context in writing the book, did you realize, did some of the good come back of those experiences?
All of the good came back. And I don't, it was an amazing childhood and youth, and I'm still connected to it and I value it. So it did, and more so than, the hardship. I think also I had the type of personality where I tend to look at the bright side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I benefited certainly more than I suffered from it, because you can be neglected by any parent, whether they're in the art world or not. I think it's more common if you have parents who are creative, and maybe this isn't true, but I did notice it a lot with with other artist children. First of all, when I was a kid, there weren't that many children in the art world.
Mm-hmm.
Artists tended not to have children. It was really hard. You had to devote so much to your career. And and the wives devoted a lot to the husbands. And certainly women artists, you know, it was an incredible struggle for them. So that's only become more recent where you know, people can have children and can have more than one life. You know, they can have their art and a life. And I think actually, you know, my parents had something to do with that. I mean, certainly my mother was on the board of the of Westbeth and was one of the, which is the oldest artist housing project, and she helped choose people to get into the building when mm-hmm. they started. And the whole idea of Westbeth was to give people, artists, a place, to a low-income place to work and to have families.
So there was no thought that an unstill wife is okay. You don't wish you had a stiller life.
Oh, sure. There were times when, you know, and I lived 3,000 miles away from my father. So certainly there's a reason for that. And I love him and I see him, but, you know, it's good to have boundaries and distance.
Right.
I'm a writer, so I require a different kind of world to produce my work. I require actually a lot of alone time, and I require, you know, I need to withdraw to write. I am not as social as my father, though I enjoy it. So I set my life up a little bit differently. But yeah, every once in a while, it's really fun to dip into the art scene and to dip into the whirlwind and, you know, to taste it again. But do I? No, it's a great story. Do I regret it? No, not at all.
Did you share the book with your father?
Oh my God, yes. I mean, not while I was writing it, and which he kept asking. But when I was in doing the galleys, he read it and he went through it with a pencil. he had some suggestions. I only took one. And then he's read it twice since then in hardback. But yes, he loves it. You know, he's a man, obviously, because of his ego and stuff. He loves attention, whether it's good or bad. You know, he's like that. So, yeah.
So if it's about him and you're talking about him,
right,
that's okay.
Right. And, yeah. You know, I didn't want it all to be about him, obviously. I mean, if you...
No, there's a lot about you, sure.
There's a lot about me, and there's a lot about my mother.
Yes.
And the women of that generation who, you know, were struggling to come into their own. And so he had wanted me to write about him for years, and I resisted because I wanted to find a way to do it where he wasn't the whole story, you know, where he didn't take it over, because he can take things over.
That was 51%'s Joe Donahue speaking with Gabrielle Sells, author of Unstill Life, a daughter's memoir of art and love in the age of abstraction, published by Norton. We turn from daughter and father to, quite simply, men and women, or perhaps not so simply.
You don't have a problem with my problem, maybe the problem simply codependency.
Daily headlines have been filled with stories of violence against women and girls and a growing attack on women's access to health care and reproductive rights. There are also signs of progress being made toward gender equality and a greater sense of shared responsibility for the future. Omega Institute in Rhinebeck, New York, home of the Omega Women's Leadership Center, will, for the first time, for its Women and Power Conference, invite men to join the stage and audience. I spoke with Carla Goldstein, co-founder of Omega Women's Leadership Center, and Michael Kimmel, a leading researcher on men and masculinity.
For 12 years, we've been focusing on the question of, you know, what does it mean as women increasingly gain power? How can we change actually how power operates in the world? How does power move from being, you know, a force of domination to a force of cooperation? What would that really look like? And every year that we've had the conference, the question of men comes up, like we know that this is something we can't do alone. But it's been important for women in the sort of historical arc of gaining our own independence, to have these spaces by ourselves to talk about what it's been like, what our experiences have been like. But meanwhile, we've had, you know, incredible brothers, fathers, sons, partners. And I think that we have gained sort of enough freedom and enough strength and enough independence that we're ready now to begin the very important conversation of how do we move beyond the polarization and how do we live in a more interdependent, full relationship with men? And how is it that gender roles really constrain men's lives and the suffering that men have to live with based on these very, very rigid role definitions of masculinity? And Michael was the first person we invited because he's been at this work of thinking about these questions for men for a very, very long time. So we were thrilled that he was going to join us, and I'd pass the conversation over to him.
Yes, Michael. So your reaction to, you know, this is the year to start this conversation, the next conversation, as it were.
Yeah, I think we're ready to have this conversation. I think that there's several different areas around this. I mean, on the one hand, I think that while the conversation among women and among women alone about questions of empowerment, and support have been really important and ought to continue, I also think that we've begun to recognize that the gender revolution, if it stalled at all, it is because there's not been a comparable engagement on the part of men. I mean, you women can lean in just so far before you realize that this wall that you're leaning against is either intractable or you're going to fall over. So while women have been leaning in, we men have not been listening up, and we need to do that. We need to listen to the kind of issues that you've been raising, and we need to listen to the kinds of concerns that women have about the relations between women and men. So this is a conversation that is sorely needed. At the same time, I would underscore that women's support of each other is vital, and the missing conversation from my mind is that men need to learn how to support each other and to challenge each other. Very often when we begin this process of moving toward a more egalitarian world, men look to women for all the support, all the all the acknowledgement, and also always in conversations, you all know this, you know, you're in a conversation and some guy says something, you know, stupid, and everybody looks at you, the woman in the room, to say, oh, is she going to say something? Well, that's not your job. That's also our job. So we need to engage in this conversation because we also need to step up to challenge each other. So what I would say in summary is really very simple. We cannot empower women and girls unless we engage men and boys. It's just that simple.
One of the big points that Michael makes and other men who are in this work is that advocating for women's equality, for gender equality, benefits men directly. It's not an indirect. It's not like, oh, I'm doing this for you. That's good. We want men to be advocating for women's full, lively, thrivelyhood. But it's also really beneficial to men and the entire society if we have a more egalitarian set of relationships. A man who lives in a family with daughters, sisters, mother, woman, you know, wife, partner, whatever the family configuration is, that family unit, that community, that state, that country is such a richer, stronger place if the women in it are fully empowered legally, economically, creatively. And so men have every interest in uplifting the legal and economic lives of women because they're in relationship to women. And men have every interest in releasing themselves from the burden of only being, you know, this rigid definition of what is masculinity and kind of living between these thin lines of what it means to be a man. And I think, Michael, you've done some amazing work of really defining what that man box looks like, and I think it would be great if you could just share a little bit of that.
Sure. Well, thanks for that lead-in, Carla. I have basically made my career in attempting to engage men to support gender equality. And men tend to relate to gender equality or the idea of, you know, women's empowerment as if it had nothing to do with them. It's very nice. You know, some men will resist it. Some men will just think it has nothing to do with them. So so the way that we typically present it to men is, oh, come on, guys, it's the right thing to do. It's fair. It's just. It's equal. It's the American way. And that, and the ethical imperative doesn't tend to resonate much with men. It tends to go, sort of sail past them. And so, and yet, if you ask, and if you ask men, do you support gender equality? Most men will say yes. If you ask them, if you were to take the word feminism and you were to make it into 10 policy initiatives, most men would support all 10 of them. But if you ask them if they're feminists or if they support feminism, like, nobody would say that. So my brief, in a sense, has been to engage men by saying, not only is this the right thing to do, not only is it inevitable, not only does the arc of history always point toward greater justice, but it is in your interest to do so. You will have much better relationships with your friends, with your partners, with your wives, with your children, in your relationship to yourself at work, at home, in recreation. You'll live longer. You'll live healthier. There's tons of evidence for this. So I want to make the argument to men that it is in your interest to support gender equality, not simply because it's right and fair and good, but because you will actually live a better life.
Is being a feminist necessary to that?
I think feminism gets a, you know, bad rap because we associate it with all kinds of, you know, sort of negative stereotypes. I think being a feminist simply means being for women's equality. And sure, it recognizes that there's inequality. You know, to support feminism, really, Allison, think about it. To support feminism as a word, as an idea, you really need to do just two things. First, you need to observe the world, and you need to say, you know what? In this world, women and men are not equal. That's all. That observation. And then the second is a moral position, and they should be. And anyone, I believe, who says in this world women and men are not equal and they should be, supports feminism.
Thank you for that. And so if you would just expand upon what you'll be bringing to the conference and what you hope conference goers will take away.
Well, what I'm going to be talking about is some of the reasons that men resist gender equality. And to talk about how gender equality remains invisible to men and what those constraints of traditional masculinity do to men in their lives. So the things that Carla referred to before, those old ideas, that straitjacket. Because one of the things that's really interesting to me as a professor is my students, my female students, you know, when I ask them, what does it mean to be a woman? They look at me like, I can be anything I want. I can go to medical school. I can go to law school. I can be a professional athlete. I can be a mom. I can be a housewife. I can do anything. And you ask the guys, what does it mean to be a man? And they give you like the most rigid, like, you know, well, means always winning, being competitive, you're stoic, never showing your feelings. The first thing that every single student says is, don't ever cry. So men still operate within constraints that, in fact, women have exploded. So I want to talk to men about the cost of that, of those, and then how we can move past them, how we can expand the possibilities for men in a more gender equal world. So I'm going to talk about why men don't think about this way, then why men resist it very often, and then what some of the research says are some of the benefits of it.
That was Omega Women's Leadership Center co-founder Carla Goldstein and Michael Kimmel, Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Gender Studies at Stony Brook University in New York, where he directs the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities. The conference, entitled Women, Men, The Next Conversation, is September 19th to the 21st on Omega's Rhinebeck, New York campus. In addition to Kimmel, other presenters include long-distance swimmer Diana Nyad, historian Stephanie Kuntz, media mogul Ted Turner, former Prime Minister of Australia Kevin Rudd, and singer-songwriter India Arie. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% Archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1311.